tonight on Arena. We have live music and poetry with Mel Mercier in band in Cork and poet Mary O'Malley in Galway. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. As part of the programme for the Clonmel Junction Festival, town native and visionary composer, arranger, player and teacher, Mihola Sulawan will be celebrated in two concerts. One of those will be curated by Mel Mercier, fellow musician, collaborator and friend of Mihola's. Mel was Mihola's student in UCC during an incredibly creative period for the composer in the 1980s. On Sunday the 29th of June in Clonmel, Mel will gather musicians to perform a concert to look back at this period in Mihola's creative life. It's called Eclego, and Mel joins me with his band of musicians from our studio in Cork. Mel, you're very welcome to Arena.
Thank you very much, Kay. Delighted to be here.
Now, you were a young fellow when you were drafted in to play on one of Mihola's compositions.
Well, actually, I was 14 years old when I met Mihola first, and I met him in the radio centre of the RTE studios in Dublin. When Mihola was in, he himself was about 24 at the time. He'd been brought in by Tony McMahon, who was recording the theme music and the little links for The Long Note. And Mihola was looking for some Bowron and some Bones, and so he contacted my father, Pather Mercier, who brought us in on the 46A bus into Donnybrook, and we met Mihola for the first time. Myself and my brother Paul played on that, and on that recording, and that was the beginning really of a kind of a lifelong musical friendship and personal friendship with Mihola.
And you being so young then when you met first, what was your relationship like? How did he come across to you when he was just so young and so vibrant and starting out on his big creative career?
Yeah, well, there was of course a sense already then that his star really was rising, and the energy and the welcome and the enthusiasm and the boldness and the inventiveness that he already showed in that first meeting and in the music that he made for The Long Note, which I still really, really love, that just grew and sustained him and many, many other people around him. You know, he was charismatic even then, and that's something that remained with him right up until the end.
I've been in his company a few times and worked with him a few times, and it's infectious really, that enthusiasm he had, and also the breadth of knowledge he had in terms of music and dance and all kinds of things, both traditional and classical, and all world musics as well, of course.
That's right. Well, you know, he had boundless energy, you know, he was so inventive. It was this combination of inventiveness and boldness, but then this extraordinary eloquence. You know, you could hear that not just in when he spoke about music or indeed about anything, but you could hear it in his music. I was very lucky to be very, very close to that for so many years, sitting in the well at the piano. But you mentioned, you know, his love for classical music and traditional music. Mihola came to traditional music, I'm going to say, relatively late. I mean, it was when he came to study music at UCC that he discovered it. He told me himself that, you know, up to that point in time, he had begun playing the piano at home in Clonmel when he was about 10, and then he was in his first rock band by the time he was 13. He was listening to classical music on the radio in his mid-teens. But actually, when he became an undergraduate student at UCC and then came under the influence of both Fleischmann and O'Riordan, that's when he began to tune into traditional music. And he told me a wonderful story about going to O'Riordan and Ceoltóirí Chulainn's final concert in Cork City Hall in 1970. Mihola didn't know anything about him. He said he knew very little about traditional music, but he was brought in as a student usher. And he said he still remembers standing at the back of the hall. He said he didn't understand the music, but he knew that something significant was happening. And so that was his sort of, entree, I suppose, into traditional music. And then, as he spoke often, he was very excited then by the space in between traditional music and classical music. So there were, of course, lots of students at UCC at that time and in most music departments who were being taught and who were playing and learning about classical music. What Micheál did was he brought traditional music into the classroom, not just the academic or historical study of it, but also the performance of it. And performance was at the heart of it. So he was really drawn to that exciting, creative, liminal, experimental space between classical music and traditional music, but also between an academic knowledge of music and a performance knowledge of music. And that's the space he brought us, his students, into.
And that was not always the most popular space to be in, was it? Like that there was very more strict ideas about what was traditional music and what was classical music then.
Well, I think there were two things. You know, there were certainly within the university there was the question about whether traditional music was worthy of study. And certainly whether the performance of the music was something that should be carried out in the institution. But, you know, Micheál felt that this in-between space was not just experimental, but it was subversive. Sometimes he used to refer to us, his students, as his co-conspirators, you know, his co-subversives. And so he was pushing against that old idea in a way that he finally achieved for traditional music an equal status with classical music. But of course, there were those outside of the university who wondered whether it was necessary for traditional music to have a life within the academy. But of course, we've moved beyond all of those now, and now we can all see the value and the richness of having the choice of going to university to study music or staying outside, studying classical music or studying traditional music, or bringing the two of them together. And of course, you know, over the last 30, 40 years, we've seen extraordinarily exciting collaborations between classical musicians, traditional musicians, popular musicians. And Micheál, I think, foresaw all of that.
Now, you have a band with you there, Mel, and we want you to play. And the first piece is a piece based on the writings of Johnny Patterson, who was an Irish-American artist. And I had something to do with this in the fact that I worked with Micheál on a previous work with Paul Durkin in County Clare, and then subsequently Patricia Kelly, the arts officer there, commissioned this work on the Johnny Patterson Circus, which they did with Theatre Omnibus. So this is the music that Micheál created in UCC for this event.
Yes, so one of the great things about Micheál was that he was an amazing teacher in the classroom, really, really inspirational. But outside of the classroom as well, he brought us on these wonderful experimental trips down to Ballyvourna, for example, down to Solon Studios, where we would make music together. And he worked very, very collaboratively. And one of the projects is the one you've spoken about, which was for the Johnny Patterson Travelling Circus. Now, there was already a traditional music ensemble, which was connected to the Traditional Music Society in UCC, which was called the Rectory Cayley Band, because the music department was in the rectory building. Now, that's rectory with a W. Mm-hmm. But for this Johnny Patterson Travelling Circus, Micheál renamed the band the Johnny Patterson Neo Cayley and All-Purpose Circus Band. And so we performed, actually, 100 years after the death of Johnny Patterson, who was from Feakill in County Clare, as you know, in 1989 in the Ennis 750 celebrations, in a big tent in the post office fields in Ennis. We dressed up in all of our circus gear. And at that time, actually, I was singing the songs using a megaphone. For this performance this evening, Fiona Kelleher, also a student of Micheál's at the time, will sing "This is the Stone Outside Dan Murphy's Door." And the other musicians who were also involved back then will play Niall Vallely, Kevin Vallely, Claire O'Loughlin and Frank Torpy, and myself rattling along on the bones.
All right, so take it away. "This is the Stone Outside Dan Murphy's Door."
It's long years ago since we left it, but return there we will if we're spared. Our friends and companions of childhood would return every night to the store. Round Dan Murphy's shop, how often we sat on the stone outside Dan Murphy's door. Those days in our hearts we will cherish, contented although we were poor. And the songs that were sung in the days we were young on the stone outside Dan Murphy's door.
That's the Johnny Patterson Neo Kalian All Purpose Circus Band there with Mel Mercier and Fiona Kelleher on vocals. Mel, I'm dancing around the studio here. It's such a piece of joie de vivre, really.
Yeah, it's really joyous, actually. And I think that's because of Micheál's arrangement of it. All of the Johnny Patterson music was like that. You know, as I was saying, this is a very experimental time. Micheál did a lot of music for the show. You may remember it yourself, Kay. He did music for The Lion Tamer. He did music for the High Wire Act.
Yes.
And then there were the songs. And they all have that kind of vitality in them. We'll also do another one on the programme, Shake Hands with Your Uncle Dan, which is a great song.
Now, the concert is something far more high-minded. It's called Eclego. And that comes from another piece Micheál composed. Tell us about that. That comes from another area in his brain.
Yes, it certainly does. You know, the idea I had for the concert was to really illuminate this period of extraordinary kind of vitality, creative vitality. And also, I think when Micheál was at the height of his powers as a teacher and a performer. But you know, there were these projects that have remained a little bit under the radar, and this is one of them, Eclego. Again, this was for us an unforgettable weekend down in Balvourna, staying for a few days and all day and all night in the studio down there with Ty Kelleher. And Micheál, as you may or may not know, when he made his first solo album in 1976, he uses a Moog synthesizer on it. And he was still playing around with that a little bit in the late 80s when we went down to Solon. And he decided that we'd make a piece that was very, very experimental, actually. And he created a backing track. We all did together. And he used a synthesizer in it. So this piece, Eclego, is probably, I think it's a bit of a stretch to say, but it's actually like an electroacoustic piece. So it's got live music mm-hmm. and then a tape that plays behind it. And it's kind of bonkers. So it's got all sorts of strange things in it where, like, the whole band, everybody in the band plays a different reel, for example, at the same time. Oh. There's a lot of cacophony and things that Micheál called, like, scrambles. So it's a 12-minute piece. It hasn't been played often at all, Kay, actually. It was played during one of the wonderful concerts, some of Micheál's final concerts with the Micheál actually made a part for it for the National Symphony Orchestra. So it's been played only a couple of times, and that's
all right.
One. So for tonight, actually, we're not going to play the whole 12 minutes. We just took a couple of the polkas from it, because this was very collaborative music making with Micheál. He at a certain point in time say, look, we need a polka. He might say, you know, Nile Valley, will you put together a polka for that? Now, this is so long ago, it's 35 years ago, that we actually don't really know who wrote these polkas, or indeed perhaps when they were written. But we've just done a short little section of two of the polkas, and they have all the energy of the piece.
Excellent. So grab the bones now, Mel, join your band, and let's hear Eclego. That was Eclego from Mel Mercier and his band. And the concert Eclego will be on Saturday the 29th of June at 8 p.m. at the Clonmel Junction Festival. More information from junctionfestival.com. It's Wednesday night, so it's TV review night. First up, we have Prime Video's My Lady Jane, a historical comedy starring Emily Bader, Rob Brydon and our own Mairead Tyres. The series is based on Joni Meadows' book, in which she reimagines the life of Lady Jane Grey, who in history was beheaded after being queen for just 9 days. Next up, Netflix have teamed up with the British screenwriter and director Rapman to develop their latest series, Supercell. It follows the story of a group of young black men and women from South London who discovers they have superpowers. And finally, Apple bring us Land of Women, inspired by Sandra Barneda's best-selling novel about a woman who is forced to flee to Spain with her mother and daughter after her husband disappears in the wake of a financial scandal. It stars Eva Longoria and Carmen Mora. I'm joined in studio now by Chris Wasser and Jen Gannon, who are here to review all three. And we'll begin with the Prime Video drama My Lady Jane, which takes us back to the 16th century to rewrite history, in particular the history of Lady Jane Grey, who was just 15 when she was crowned Queen of England, who lasted for 9 days before she was executed by order of Mary Tudor. Now, I'm a bit of a history nerd, so I knew about Lady Jane Grey, but most people might not.
No, they might not. But it's a historical reimagining of the life of Lady Jane Grey. And there's a little bit of an animated segment at the top that kind of gives you a bit of a history lesson and says that she kind of took the throne from Edward IV. She was the great niece of Henry VIII. Mary I should have been the successor of Edward IV, but she got it. There wasn't an awful lot of support for her. So she was actually convicted of treason after 9 days and beheaded. And this, what's supposed to be a humorous voiceover courtesy of Oliver Chris, tells us or asks us, what if things were different? What if she wasn't beheaded? So you think
when you say humorous, what do you mean?
Well, this show is trying to tickle our funny bones, but it actually ends up annoying us, I found. But basically, the premise is we were introduced to this Lady Jane Grey, who is a gifted intellectual and aspiring botanist, and she longs to live a life that isn't planned out for her by her irksome mother, played by Anna Chancellor. Her mother wants to basically marry her off because theirs is a home without a father, without a patriarch, and they need the money. And she spots this wealthy Lord Dudley, played by Rob Brydon. He has a very handsome, dashing son. Lady Jane Grey is not too fond of him. She's heard stories about him. But the goal here for Lady Frances, that's Jane's mother, is to marry off the daughter. The family will be okay. The only thing is, Dudley and Jane are not too fond of one another. And of course, actually, I should say, none of this is really important, because what's actually really going on here is a story about royals and people who can turn into animals. You think you're going into this you think you're going into this funny historical reimagining, as I say, but really it's actually a fantasy.
Yes, because we see that the Lady Jane Grey character is witch-like in the fact that she has special powers, because she uses, not special powers, but she sees the power of plants and the natural world. But then all of a sudden that is pushed further in this series.
Yeah, it is. And it's a weird one, as Chris was saying, because on the one hand, why I felt myself going, why did they need the historical basis at all for this show? You know, why make it Lady Jane at all, where they could have just created this character and had something completely original? Using the backstory or using it as a basis didn't really work for me, because they didn't really do anything except have this historical setting. And to me, in my mind, what is happening here is they're looking at this genre that's almost, well, it's a new kind of genre of that anachronistic period drama, because, you know, we've had so many iterations of it recently. We've something like even the very sweary Mary and George this year. You've had
The Great.
Well, and like we had something like Buccaneers last year, which was like based on Edith Wharton, but it was last novel, unfinished novel, but it's also kind of aimed at teenagers. And then obviously we have Bridgerton, which is the all dominating.
Yes, and you have
Bridgerton.
That idea of the Tony McNamara, the writer of The Great, that way of sending up historical characters.
And it is like from the opening seconds of this show, we're treated with this maximum swearing and some very interesting examination of the female anatomy. And, you know, My Lady Jane, it tries desperately hard to shock, I think, tries to be confrontational. And for in my mind, it just didn't pay off, that it didn't work in that way.
Well, let's hear a clip so people get an idea of the tone. Lady Jane, here played by Emily Bader, talks to her handmaids, Mairead Tyre and Bryony Corrigan, about preferring the study of herbs and medicine to marriage.
So, when's Mac Honey set for shagging?
A few weeks.
I can't abstain for a few weeks.
Could you?
I couldn't. Jane wouldn't know.
She's a lady, saving herself for marriage.
I'm saving myself for myself, actually. In fact, I may never marry. Yes, mock the person who's curing your vagina.
But how will you live? What will you do?
What would your mother say?
Lady Frances doesn't know.
I don't really care what she thinks. I've got bigger plans.
Go on, tell her.
I'm writing the world's first complete compendium of England's medicinal herbs and their uses.
Herbs?
Herbs. Herbs. Text and drawings for those who can't read. I intend to publish it and sell it. Perhaps I can make enough money to actually live independently. Where is the bloody calendula officinalis?
Jane.
Found it.
Duke of Leicester is coming.
Bollocks, is that today? She told me to get flowers.
So there's obviously a lot of rotting in the kitchen to say that the poor maid needs such balms for her safekeeping.
Yeah, that's actually the opening sequence. And also the last we see, well, we see a little bit of Mairead Tyres in the first episode, but she sort of disappears because she is what's known as an Aethian, one of the characters who can actually turn into birds. And Edward IV, played by Jordan Peters, he is seen as hating the Aethians. And, you know, he has them hunted and locked up. But when one of them actually comes to try and save his life, because everyone believes that he is dying of the affliction, but actually he's been poisoned, he has to trust them.
He's an interesting character, isn't he? Because he is the sickly king of England. But is he really sickly, or is somebody poisoning him?
That's the
and
thing,
this is the Dominic Cooper character, who's a very interesting character.
He is, and he camps it up, like, and that's what the best of the cast can do with this material, I think. And you do have a great cast, and I think Dominic Cooper is one of the standout, because he is, you know, diving into being, you know, villainous and treacherous and slippery, and that's enjoyable to watch. And I do think, though, you know, I mean, on the whole, you have Jim Broadbent, you've got Rob Brydon, you know,
and they're having a laugh,
and they are having a really good time. And I do think that with, you know, Badr and Bluemail as the two main kind of romantic leads, there is great chemistry between them, but I just think that the story is letting them down, and the way it's presented is letting them down, unfortunately.
Yeah. Stars out of five for you, Jen?
I would give it a two, unfortunately.
And you, Chris?
I think it has a bit of an identity crisis. I think there are some big messages in there and big themes that it doesn't really know what to do with. Like, the Aethians might be some sort of metaphor or analogy for, you know, religious wars or religious differences, the persecution of innocent civilians in the 16th century. There definitely is something there, but I don't think it's handling it. I think it's going for the great, it's going for Bridgerton, it's going for Mary and George, but it ends up looking and sounding like drunk history. So it's two out of five for me.
Okay, two out of five for both of you. That was for My Lady Jane. Then Netflix brings us a gritty new superhero drama created by Rapman and starring Doctor Who's Tushin Cole. It follows the lives of five seemingly unconnected Black South Londoners whose lives change forever when they develop superpowers, and not all of them are happy about it. So in episode one, we're brought into the lives of a group of young people. Some of them connect with each other, some don't, and we wonder, what's it all about? You just think it's a gritty South London drama.
That's the kind of great thing about Supercell, because it doesn't, it kind of leads you in where you do think it is just about this disparate group of South Londoners. You have, you know, a delivery driver, a frantic divorced dad, a troubled nurse, a brutal gang leader, and this cheeky weed dealer, and they're all living their lives and hardscrabble lives, and they're going through various difficult, you know, difficulties within themselves, and then you slowly but surely realise that they actually all have superpowers. And the thing about it is, it's not, it's treading old ground in a way, because instantly I think anybody who's a watcher of TV would think of Heroes, or they would think of something like Misfits, which kind of dealt in the grittier area of the superhero. Like, we're trying to do things with superheroes now in this post like MCU universe where we're like, what is, can we get the root to the nub of what we think about these types of characters, like something with The Boys, where we were talking about it a couple of weeks ago, where it's like dealing with, you know, it's acerbic, it's a satire, and it's about like our own kind of need to have these people to worship. Whereas this is very much more in line with misfits and heroes, as in what happens when these normal people with these problems attain these powers. And the powers can be anything from like turning into the Flash to disappearing to stopping time. And they're all, you know, it's more about the relationships and the characters themselves than what they're going to do with the powers, because it's not like they're world beaters. It's not like they're going to, you know, join forces or whatever and go against, you know, someone else that's deadly. It's not about that. It's more about the smaller moments and the intricacies of their lives.
Yes, because Chris, I like Jen, was very drawn into their lives and their individual dilemmas.
Yeah.
So when they get these superpowers, whether it's to run quicker or to be able to repel things, does their life get better?
Not immediately. And that's actually one of the coolest things about it, that when they're as shocked as we are to see that they can do the things that they can do. I mean, Michael, who's a delivery driver, he should be dead. He delivers a parcel to an estate where he's told that he needs to pay a fee to these local gangsters, and they stab him. And it's while he's lying on the ground that he flashes back 5 minutes, and he thinks maybe, you know, he might be losing his mind or it might be a premonition, but he realizes, no, he can travel through time. And when he starts telling people about this, they're shocked and they don't believe him. And I like that. It's not like in DC or Marvel where if someone says, you know, they can run faster than a speeding bullet, everyone just believes them straight away. There's doubt there. And it is quite, you know, there's a realistic reaction basically from everyone. And I quite like that Andrew Rapman on Mobolo, who writes and directs, he wrote everything, directed three of the episodes. He is very good at applying socially conscious or like genre defying stories to real life situations. He did it very well in 2019's Blue Story, which told this fascinating story of a postcode gang war between two rival London boroughs. But he did it, he added a lot of Shakespearean tragedy. He did it where most of the dialogue was actually rhyme, was hip hop. He's doing that here. He's giving us real life drama. He's giving us a story that talks and deals with racism, with knife crime, with, you know, workplace discrimination among Black South Londoners. You know, there's an awful lot going on there. It just so happens to be a superhero story as well.
Okay, and do you think there was a need for the superhero?
I mean, sometimes I did and sometimes I didn't, because at the same time, I liked the fact that when it's dealing with the powers, it's kind of, because it's thrust upon them, like their predicaments only become exacerbated and magnified in a way, because, you know, they're desperate people and they're all in desperate situations in some kind of way. So they have this misguided thinking, and it's not like the powers are solving any of their problems. In reality, it's probably actually giving them more problems. But I did think, like Chris is saying, when he digs into the socioeconomic issues, it's much better. And I liked just watching those characters interact and those stories, not necessarily with the bells and whistles of the superpowers
so
on top of them.
So stars out of 5, Jen, for a supercell from you.
I will give it 3. I think there is a problem with the writing. I think there are interesting points about, you know, issues about, you know, Love Island and how they present Black women and the inherent racism within the lack of attention given to Black missing people. But they all land with this very artless thud to very clunky dialogue. I think he needs a little bit of help. He can't do everything himself. He's not a superhero. Rapman, you're not a superhero. So I think take
okay,
the help.
Rapman needs help. What about you, Chris?
Yeah, I agree, actually. A collaborator might have cleaned things up here. And it is a bit of a bumpy ride, but it's well performed. He wears his influence as well. There's a bit of Jordan Peele, there's a bit of Boots Riley in there, Tim Kring. But he has his own voice, his own good ideas, and he's also reinvigorating a genre that we've grown quite tired
of. Stars, Chris.
3 stars.
3 stars. 3 for both of you from Supercell. Now, Land of Women stars Eva Longoria as Gala, a wine expert who is living in the dream in New York with her husband and daughter. But we quickly discover that all is not as it seems, as Gala's life, as she knows it, starts to crumble. Chris, tell us about Gala, played by Eva Longoria. She seems to have the high life, but
she has everything. Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
But the husband, he's a bad'un.
He's a bit of a fool. She is a wealthy New Yorker of Spanish heritage, but as you say, her wealthy life comes crashing down overnight. She sent her 17-year-old daughter off to boarding school, and there's a bit of an empty nest problem going on where, you know, she's kind of like, what do I do now? She decides to open a wine store. And on the opening night of this wine store, some heavies approach and they tell her that her husband owes some very bad people $15 million. The husband then scarpers, leaving her penniless and terrified, and she realizes that she is going to have to get out of town. She's going to have to take her daughter with her because, you know, those bad people will come after her nearest and dearest. And she's also going to have to take her mother out of this very pricey retirement resort. And it's when she goes to pick up the mother that she is informed that 50 years before that, her mother Julia, she actually fled to and lived in this small little idyllic town in northern Spain. So she sells her jewellery and decides, I'll use the cash from this jewellery to fly us all there and we'll start a new life and hide away from the gangsters.
So Jen, this sounds like something that they'd usually end up in Ireland with.
Yes.
Yeah, and it sounds like, you know, what was that awful thing about time?
Yeah, well, I mean, it is like Wild Mountain Time, but it's not really. It reminded me of those, we always say, oh look, they don't make them like they used to, in terms of whether we're talking about an erotic thriller or, you know, a rom-com or this, which is like these mid-budget productions where, you know, you would see a trailer for it and be like, from the director of Under the Tuscan Sun comes, you know, and it's very much this, it's a fish out of water story and it's very generic. We've seen this before, we know these characters, but that is kind of what makes it work so well. You're so comfortable. You're already, like, within 20 minutes of the first episode, the setup is so telegraphed. You know exactly what you're getting. You know exactly where this is going
to go. Yeah, she comes into the rural community. There's a beautiful
man. There's a will they, won't they.
With a vineyard.
Yes, I mean, and, you know, there's that typical, oh, the car breaks down, I'm covered in mud, that kind of, you know, you have that from everything from Leap Year to Irish Wish. You have the same kind of tropes. But there is something winning about this. There is something charming about the stories of these three different women at different times of their lives. And I found, you know, her mother Julia's story to be the most effective, secretly enough. She's the kind of secret weapon of the show.
Because she has a whole past life in this village.
She's a strange sister that she, you know, she's coming back to a very small village where, you know, they're not exactly happy to see her. They're not exactly thrilled. This is not the homecoming that she expected or wanted or thought she'd have. So there's a lot to be dug up in the past, and there's a lot in their relationship with, like, the three women together. I think it's really weirdly strong, and it's like, it's cozy, familiar comfort watching, which is no bad thing.
Okay, well, let's listen to a clip. This is from early in the first episode. Gala, Eva Longoria and her mother Carmen Mora have now got together. They pull over to her daughter's school to discover Kate Victoria Bazua kissing a girl who the women do not approve of.
Isn't that your mother?
Mom?
Kate! Hi! Hi, Mrs. Scott!
Maggie! So good to see you.
Dissimula fatal. Cállate, mamá.
I don't think she likes me.
No, of course she does. I'll see you tonight, okay?
¿No te alegras de que tu hija tenga novia?
Claro que me alegra que tenga novia, pero no que sea Maggie.
What are you doing here?
Okay, now you don't listen to my messages either?
Mom, stop.
Okay, it's a surprise. Girls trip! Ta-da!
But they may not like Kate's new girlfriend, but I think you like Land of Women.
Yeah, weirdly enough, it really won me over. I did not expect, I thought everything about it, it looks like it could be constructed from AI. Like, I mean, it really feels like that. But at the same time, there's something to it that it has this heart, maybe, that we're kind of missing in TV this day. And like, I think Apple, it's a really weird show for something as a prestige streamer for Apple to choose, but I'm glad they did it.
Stars out of five from
I'm
you,
Jen. I'm going to give it a nice, healthy three.
3 out of 5.
Yeah, that Apple budget was put to good use. It's a beautiful looking show. You can feel the warmth and the sunshine off of it. I think these kinds of shows are very easy to mock, but we shouldn't, because this type of dramedy is trickier to pull off than even the most serious shows, or even the most serious drama. And I think Longoria, who is just brilliant with physical comedy, is an absolute pro here. So in a word, irresistible. 3 stars.
And 3 stars. Thank you very much, Chris Wasser and Jen Gannon. Supercell, My Lady Jane and Land of Women were the shows they reviewed. The Shark Nursery is a new collection from poet Mary O'Malley, a book that, as Walt Whitman would say, contains multitudes. As hinted in its title, Shark Nurseries, O'Malley creates a world where the natural, the online and the mythic mingle. I'm delighted that Mary O'Malley joins me on the line from Galway. Hello, Mary, you're so welcome.
Thank you very much.
Now, Mary, we'd love to start with a poem. Will we start with The Shark Nursery? Would you talk us into it and then maybe read it for us?
Sure. The Shark Nursery is pretty simple poem, really. It's about a creature who suddenly realises that he's not a reviled little thing called a fiagach, a little spiny, unwanted and inedible fish. But he's now been classified as a shark, and I wrote it after I saw a headline saying, rare shark nursery discovered off the west coast of Ireland, I think it said. And it's a poem about, I give the little fish a voice.
Oh, lovely. So shark.
But the shark in question is, in fact, a dogfish.
Great. So will you read it for us, please, Mary?
Yes. I am dogfish. When I hatch, I threaten nobody. We gather in nesting places in rock and coral. I am harmless, thrown back by trawler man. Nobody eats me. Today we're in the news. Scientists have observed a rare shark nursery off the west coast. Now we have status. I'm a shark suddenly, and my young, safe in their mermaid's purses, are treasure in a coral room. I am a black-mouthed cat shark now, shown some respect. That's nice, but inside, I am still a dogfish reviled.
Fantastic. The Shark Nursery there from Mary O'Malley's new collection, the title poem from that. So the old dogfish got a promotion. He might be sorry to get.
He might. And also, obviously, there's a certain amount of metaphor for social media where, you know, people are famous in their own for 5 minutes, and you know, he's starting to get notions now.
Now, your fascination with the knowledge of the sea is no surprise. You grew up in the fishing village of Albrach, is that the right pronunciation?
That's
near Ballyconeely, yeah, in Connemara. So how inspirational has that place been to you, and describe it for us, Mary?
Well, place is very important to me, and I think if you grow up in a particularly it was a very beautiful landscape to grow up in, and it's also quite a harsh landscape off season, you know. And if you were dependent on the sea for a living, as my family was, then obviously it takes yet another jump in its importance in your life. So our lives were seasonal, if you like. The place itself is coastal. We live near the sea. There's large areas of commonage, which are lovely, beautiful, full of wildflowers and so on. And we grew up used to seeing in their season basking sharks, seals, otters occasionally. You know, that was part of life.
And Albrach itself means a speckled cliff. Is that
it
right?
It does.
And is there such a speckled cliff there?
Well, there was. And this is part of the whole sort of theme running through the book, which is traces and how traces remain, you know. And when I was a child, I was shown that speckled rock, as it was, really. Even then, it was a bit of a cliff. And then gradually it kind of eroded and a bit of it fell away. And now I think there's just a trace of it left. But I think language, those traces are left in the language. So, you know, it's left in the name. And so long after the rock is gone, I like to think that the name, even in English, will continue to bear the traces.
Now, your father's boat, Glóithoig, is that the right?
Glóithoig.
Yeah. It gets a mention in Lockdown O'Bad, a poem which can be found on the stone plaque in the Claddagh Basin in Galway City, as well as in this collection. So how did it start out as an idea for you, and how did it end up in a plaque in the Claddagh?
Well, the idea was very simple. It was the first easy walk I had after that very long lockdown, where you could actually walk away from home. And I walked early one morning on the, you know, through the town and over the bridge and facing the Claddagh. And I saw a couple of people in the boats that are moored in the Claddagh Basin. And they're traditional boats, hookers and perhaps a glóithoig, I think. And when I was walking back, they were actually lifting the sails. And in fact, that is the centre of the poem. And those sails resemble because of their colour, I felt they resembled monarch butterflies, you know, as if they were just lifting us out of this awful period we'd been in. And it was just a moment of such pure joy for me.
And then that's when Tom Kenny, when he saw the poem then, thought it should be on one of the plaques they put up in Galway.
Yeah, Tom Kenny actually asked me for something. And I finished the poem for the plaque, in fact. I had already more or less drafted it. But then I finished it because I thought this is the one poem that I want to go there.
Now, as you said, that there was a lot of poems in the Shark Nursery were written during lockdown or after. Was your writing and reading affected during that time?
It was. I didn't find it a very good time for writing at all, to be honest. And I had an awful lot of drafts and a lot of notes. And I didn't like lockdown one little bit. But I suppose it did give me time for rereading. So I did a lot of rereading, you know, back to the Iliad, which opens with a pandemic, which I hadn't reread in a very long time. The Odyssey I had. And back to Milton, because I found time, something very strange happened to time during the pandemic. It sort of condensed and concertinaed out, you know, because we didn't have the usual markers of getting up, work, what day is it, going here, going there. And so time became sort of strange to me. So I thought a lot about time, and I wrote quite a bit in this book about time as well.
Cornflowers is another poem that was written during lockdown. Maybe you talk us into that and read it for us.
Yeah, it was on an anniversary of my nephew. It's dedicated in memory of my nephew, who died many years ago. But it's also, in a way, in memory of everyone who died during lockdown, because we were, you know, we had no way to mourn them collectively.
Yes.
And I think that caused a lot of... I think that was one of the most difficult things for people.
So maybe you'd read that for us, Mary.
Cornflowers. They leave us at a still point, recede into the terrifying beauty of time, and come back like cornflowers blooming on All Souls' Night, a boy's face imprinted on each flower, or a girl's eyes, blue butterflies, landing in October. In this moment of evening, before the light fails, an arm with a silver watch in a sleeve of blue linen lies stilled across a white notebook, and we are face to face briefly in Albrach, on Arran, in Desplaines. We are hidden in time's folds between a rack of conditionals, the past and future tenses. Look, they said, we need grammar to parse time. Yes, tomorrow will be November, but in this new garden, the cornflowers are still blooming.
That's very beautiful. That's Cornflowers from Mary O'Malley's new collection called Shark Nursery. Mary, land and animals as well as sea creatures feature a lot in the Shark Nursery. I suppose that goes back to your whole idea of nature and being born by and brought up by the sea. But you've got a poem called Wolf Song in memory of the late Evan Boland. You're imagining a wolf walking along an empty beach in California.
Yeah.
What did Evan Boland mean to you?
Oh, Evan Boland meant a great deal to me. She had taken an interest in, a kind interest in my work quite early on. And we got to know one another quite well and stayed in touch most of her life. And when she died, I was just stunned. And again, we couldn't go to the funeral. And I just sat down and wrote this poem, almost all of it quite quickly, which doesn't always happen, doesn't often happen. I kept thinking of her being in California, which of course she had taught in California for many years, in Stanford. And during lockdown, I had seen a lot of footage of wild animals coming into the cities. And they were the images, particularly the wolf, which in a way stands for poetry itself, I suppose, that kept coming to me. But I was also thinking, I can't, you know, Ivan had such an absolutely rigorous craft that, you know, it was quite, in a way, it was a very challenging poem as well. And I just kept seeing her. I just kept seeing her and seeing these animals. So that's really where the poem came from.
And of course, Ivan was a great woman in terms of using mythology in her poetry. And you yourself said you went back to reading the classics. And the classics again play a big role in some of the poems here, Medea and our own Sweeney.
Yeah, and the thing about it is that Ivan and Adrian Rich, whom I also had the good fortune to meet through Ivan, they did something different with myth. They sort of did a certain reinvention of how they handled myth and showed me another way to deal with it, and which was very powerful and very important to me still, actually. Ivan was a wonderful teacher in that respect.
How would you explain what they did that was different?
Well, there was nothing romantic about their use of mythology.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't heroic.
No, it was not really. No, not at all. And, you know, Rich's great poem, Diving into the Wreck, puts paid to that notion. And but also it was still had great relevance in their own lives as they when they were happening. And I think that's the great strength of myth. It remains relevant.
Well, Mary, so nice to talk to you. Mary O'Malley's new collection is The Shark Nursery. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Liam Murphy and Paula Shields. Niall McMonagall is on sound. Ollie Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's show was produced by Therese Kelly. And John Creedon is up next after the news at 8.